Welcome to the Naval Academy Museum's Warrior Writers Podcast. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, and this 14-part series will take you decade by decade, starting with the 1870s, discussing the personalities, technologies, and events that helped shape today's U.S. Navy. This podcast coincides with the Naval Academy Museum's exhibit, Warrior Writers, the U.S. Naval Institute, open from September 10th, 2015, through January 31st, 2016. Our guest for each episode leading us through the decades will be first Naval Academy History Professor Emeritus and noted historian Craig Simons, who is awarded the Samuel Eliot Morison Prize for his novel Neptune, The Allied Invasion of Europe and the D-Day Landing, and is also author of the upcoming book, A Concise History of the U.S. Navy. Craig will be followed by the director of the Naval Academy Museum, Claude Barrabe. Craig, it's hard to think of the 1930s without thinking about the looming World War that began at the end of the decade. But of course, the people at the start of the decade didn't know what was coming. What type of issues dominated Navy thinking when we kicked off the 1930s?
Well, of course, the first issue that dominates almost everybody's thinking in 1930 is the ongoing economic depression. The previous October in 1929, the crash of the market, which some people thought might be a temporary glitch and good times would begin again. By 1930, it had become pretty evident that this had ushered in a pretty, not to make a pun out of it, but depressing era, not only economically, but psychologically. And the conventional responses to bad economic times, in those days at least, pre-Keynesian, was that, well, we have to cut back our spending. We have to spend less. We have to hoard and save. That's kind of the way a family would respond to desperate economic times. And in some respects, the Hoover administration tried to apply that on a national level, which, of course, we've since learned is almost the opposite of the way to go. So the Depression became worse in the 1931 and 1932 and led to a political revolution of sorts with the election of Franklin Roosevelt. So the Depression and the economic contraction that triggered meant that the Navy, which a lot of people did not see as an immediate necessity, was going to be starved a little bit of support and financial backing, even more than in the 1920s. So that was a big issue. And I think tied with that, and really almost part of it, is that in 1930 also, the great nations of the world met at another conference in an effort to halt and even turn back expenditures on naval construction. You know, there had been this, we talked last time, I think, about the Washington Naval Conference of 1921-22, where the great powers had agreed on a ratio, a battleship ratio among themselves. Now they were going to try to extend that to other ships as well, cruisers, destroyers. And in fact, the United States delegation came to that conference, which was held in London in 1930, with orders to try to ban submarines entirely, submarines like gas warfare and germ warfare would become illegal even to possess, much less to use. That did not happen, obviously, but there was a very strong effort to limit construction of cruisers in particular, as well as battleships. So I think the conflation of the economic depression and the London Treaty of 1930 led to most countries, and including and perhaps even especially the United States, to cut back on the size and strength of its Navy.
One of the interesting things about the treaty period, and as you mentioned, we did touch on it on our last episode, was that the U.S. Navy really didn't stretch to the limits during the 1920s. And in the 1930s, was the Navy at last starting to build up to the treaty limits that it was allowed? And what type of ships were we really focused on building during the 1930s?
Yeah, well, actually, we did not, as I just suggested, immediately begin to build up in the early 1930s. In fact, one of the things that characterized American participation in both treaty agreements in 1922 and 1930 was that we did not even build up to what we were allowed to have it wasn't that we negotiated a bad deal. We were allocated the largest amounts of both battleships and cruiser tonnage co-equally with Great Britain on the planet, but we didn't build up to that, and the Depression is part of that reason. But that changed in 1933. Franklin Roosevelt came to office, obviously riding the wave of concern about the economic circumstances, and right away jumped into this famous 100 days of new legislation. But people tend to overlook the fact that Franklin Roosevelt had been a Navy man really all his life. He grew up on the banks of the Hudson River, learned to sail a boat almost before he could walk. He read his cousin Theodore's History of the War of 1812. He read Mahan when he was, I don't know, he was 12 or 13 years old, which is kind of a slog for a 12-year-old, if you can imagine that. And he had been Woodrow Wilson's Assistant Secretary of the Navy during the First World War. So he was very much a pro-Navy guy to begin with. But in addition to that, an added benefit was naval construction was a job creator. And one of the things he wanted to do when he became president in 1933 was create more job opportunities. So he could kill two birds with one stone in a way. And I guess the first kind of milestone moment in this new trajectory for the Navy came in 1934 with the passage of the Vinson-Trammell Act. Carl Vinson of Georgia particularly pushed it. He was one of the ones that helped convince Franklin Roosevelt this was a good way to go about job creation, building more ships. Carl Vinson, of course, just by, as an aside, and I think it's an interesting one, is of all of our current nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, only two of them are not named for presidents of the United States, and one of those is the USS Carl Vinson, CVN-70. And he earned that by his staunch support for naval expansion in the 1930s when it was critical. So in 1934, partly due to Carl Vinson, partly due to Franklin Roosevelt and a compliant Congress, we did finally begin to build, not yet up to the limits authorized by the treaties, but a new aircraft carrier, 65 new destroyers, 30 submarines, some 1,200 or 1,300 military aircraft, another one of Franklin Roosevelt's particular interests. So we can see in the 1930s, the mid-1930s, the beginnings of a revival of the Navy.
As a nation, we looked west. Obviously, there was Japan on the other side of the Pacific. How did American relations with Japan evolve during the course of the decade? And War Plan Orange obviously was a big player in the prior decade. And did that still dominate our thinking during the course of the 30s?
It did, more than ever, in fact. You mentioned at the beginning of the podcast how it's hard to look at the 1930s without thinking about the war that's coming. And you, in hindsight now, we can look at the 1930s and United States relations with Japan and measure that approaching cataclysm. In the beginning of the decade, the Japanese invaded Manchuria, making it essentially a puppet state, which they called Manchukuo. And there was a lot of discussion in the United States about the extent to which America should hold itself responsible for the territorial integrity of parts of China. You know, the issue of to what extent are we the world's policemen? To what extent do we have to go into other parts of the world and make sure people behave themselves? We very much disapproved of what Japan was doing in China, but weren't quite sure what we could or should do about it. And what we did do about it was adopt a policy since known as the Stimson Doctrine that, well, we won't go in there and with military force and compel you to leave, but we will demonstrate our disapproval, if you would, and opposition by refusing to recognize diplomatically or politically what you have done. We will not authorize a recognition of Manchukuo as a country. We will condemn you internationally, and it was partly in response to this, of course, that the League of Nations subsequently expelled Japan as an aggressor nation. So that kind of marked the beginning of a decade of suspicion, of antagonism between the United States and Japan. And you mentioned Plan Orange. Plan Orange had been on the books, along with many others. There were a number of color plans devoted to other potential opponents, but Plan Orange was the one we thought was most likely to come into play, and that was the war plan against Japan. And that was worked on and war-gamed at the War College in Newport, certainly more than any other contingency plan. And as a result of that, the development of amphibious capabilities for the Marine Corps, the idea of seizing advanced bases and so on, all of this became more and more part of almost standard doctrine for the United States. So the United States was developing and improving Plan Orange throughout the decade. And then finally, I guess the third thing is that in 1937, I guess toward the end of this decade, Japan invades China proper. It's almost unimaginable, thinking about it, that a nation as relatively small as Japan would invade a virtual continent of mainland China, but had great success on the battlefield, but great difficulty in consolidating that battlefield success into a political triumph. So the war in China, which the Japanese called the China Incident, was a festering sore between the United States and Japan from 1937 onward. The 1937, in particular, I should mention, was difficult in this relationship because that is the year of two things. One was what's popularly come to be known as the Rape of Nanking, that is, the application of military force to an urban center, aerial bombardment, long-range artillery, widespread death of civilians. The numbers are open to dispute, but the numbers as high as 300,000 civilians killed. And at the same time that was going on, an American gunboat operating on the Yangtze River, of course this is inland China, mind you, but nevertheless, an American U.S. Navy gunboat operating on the Yangtze River was attacked pretty clearly, deliberately, by Japanese military aircraft, and film footage of that was shown in the theaters in the United States. So here's the United States attacking the American flag. So these two events together, the rape of Nanking, the attack on the gunboat, which was the USS Panay, pretty much was a tipping point in bitterness between the United States and Japan in the 1930s.
When you look at the stories of naval development in the decade, you know, cruiser development is fascinating. There's a couple of great books that have been put out, some by the Naval Institute, that kind of outlines that evolution real nice. But when you really look at leaps of thinking and technology and capability, the great development story of this decade is obviously that of U.S. naval aviation. And clearly, naval aviation and air power in general was critical in the coming World War. Did we really start to get a handle on that in the 1930s, and did we plan accordingly, and how did that evolve during the course of the decade?
Well, that's a great question. You know, the extent to which the United States is prepared or forward-thinking at any given moment in its history for what comes next is a bit problematical. We are a nation that thinks of peace as the default situation, and therefore we tend to be tardy in preparation for the next war. I think that's probably less true in the 1930s than it is elsewhere in our history. Let me mention cruisers first. It's kind of interesting that cruisers do go through, as you mentioned, this period of development. And I think one of the reasons that's true is that these naval limitation treaties declared that any vessel that displaced more than 10,000 tons was a battleship. And any vessel that carried a gun bigger than 8 inches was a battleship. So, of course, what the Western nations did was learn how to put the most number of guns, the most advanced technology, into a hull that was exactly 10,000 tons and carried no gun larger than exactly 8 inches. And I think this led to some very tight planning in naval architecture, so that the development of cruisers, heavy cruisers in particular, that is sometimes called treaty cruisers, the 10,000-ton cruisers, was developed in a way because of the treaties, which is a rather curious development. But you're right about aviation. This is a decade when naval aviation becomes absolutely essential. And what we see playing out in the 1930s very clearly is that at the beginning of the decade, there was still a very strong feeling that lighter-than-aircraft blimps, dirigibles, would somehow be the weapon of the future. It's curious to read some of the sort of science fiction naval literature of the early 1930s and certainly in the 1920s, when the next war is perceived to be a war where dirigibles will fly over cities and drop bombs. This is, for many people, going to be the coming thing. That begins to erode pretty dramatically during the 1930s by several specific incidents. The biggest that people remember, I think, is the Hindenburg, which in 1937, the same year as Nanking and the Panay, the Hindenburg explodes in Lakehurst, New Jersey, having made a transatlantic crossing, hydrogen-filled, of course, in those days, burns under the lens of live movie cameras so that it made all of the movie theaters with a great loss of life. So that's a famous one. But in addition to that, the U.S. Navy had dirigibles located on both coasts, and in 1933, 4 years before the Hindenburg, the Akron, then called, I think, the USS Akron, in fact, crashed and killed the head of the Bureau of Aeronautics, William A. Moffett, who was one of the champions of naval aviation. So he's killed in 1933, and 2 years later, the Macon also crashed with loss of life. And those events, I think, led to a reevaluation. Maybe this is not the technology of the future. Combined with that is the emergence of these large flat deck carriers, the Lexington and the Saratoga, each of them built on a battlecruiser hull in the late 1920s, now operating with the fleet in the 1930s. Their capability during the annual war exercises becomes so evident that building airplanes for carrier use now emerges as the dominant expectation of naval aviation in the coming war. And fleet exercise, I think it's 13 in 1932, again proved that carriers were even more important than battleships, which for a surface warfare officer was, you know, apostasy in these war games. And so from the middle of 1930s onward, naval aviation doesn't mean dirigibles anymore. It means carriers, it means big carriers, it means bombers and scout planes and fighters that can fly off those carriers. So this is almost a revolution in naval aviation.
And as a decade comes to a close, when war finally broke out in Europe in 1939, how did the U.S. initially react?
Well, the United States formally reacted by declaring its neutrality, as it had done in 1914 when the First World War broke out. But there's a big difference. In 1914, Woodrow Wilson went before the American public and said, "We are going to be absolutely neutral in this war. We will be neutral in thought," he says, "as well as in deed. We will not even take sides in this war." That does not happen in 1939. Roosevelt makes it clear that we are neutral. We don't want to get sucked into this thing. We don't want American boys to be killed. But we know who the good guys are, and we know who the bad guys are, and we're going to do whatever we can within the law, and in Roosevelt's case, maybe even beyond that, to make sure that the British survive this war, the British and French initially, and then, of course, after Dunkirk, the British alone, by providing whatever support we can just barely this side of violating the neutrality laws, and in some cases even maybe stepping over that line. He declared the creation of what he called a neutrality patrol 200 miles out from the American coast. But one of the aspects of that patrol, well, there were two. One was that it provided wartime-like training, you know, with going to general quarters regularly, blacked out at night and so forth, wartime training for the men that would eventually be the petty officers on the greatly expanded fleet of the 1940s. But also, while they were at sea, they were instructed to broadcast the location of any Axis vessel it encountered in English, in plain language. I mean, clearly not directly in an effort to aid the British, but I think everybody, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, knew that our intention was to provide whatever support we could, not just we'll hold your coat, not just we'll cheer for you, but what can we do for you, provide you information. And, of course, that culminates, and we can talk about this, I suppose, next time, in the destroyer deal and lend lease and a number of other activities that are not quite neutral in character and demonstrate Roosevelt's determination to support the Allied cause.
And with that, Craig, we will leave the 1930s. Look forward to the next episode where we get to cover that great arc from 1940 through 1949 and the World War that dominated the 1940s.
And I can't imagine how we're going to do that in 15 to 20 minutes, but we'll see. Thanks, Sal. It was fun.
We'll talk to you next week. Claude, as a nation as a whole, the 1930s were dominated by the Great Depression and the huge societal and cultural changes that took place during that process. It was also a great period of change for our U.S. Navy. When you walk into the Naval Academy Museum, what are some of those exhibit items from the 1930s that people would find very interesting?
Well, specifically for the Warrior Rider exhibit, we have the Congressional Award, the gold medal that was given to Admiral Hyman Rickover. He had, of course, written for Proceedings as a young lieutenant. So again, we see this new generation, another new generation, taking the helm, thinking about the issues, writing about the world around them. In Rickover's case, he's writing about international law and the use of submarine operations and tactics. We have epaulettes from Commander John S. McCain. That's eventually Admiral Slew McCain. He is the first of four John McCains to graduate from the Naval Academy. We have a swagger stick and a sword from General Wallace Greene, Commandant, the 23rd Commandant of the United States Marine Corps, who had graduated from the Academy in 1930. And we have a portrait of Logan Carlisle Ramsey Sr. And I think if anybody represented the prescient nature of this new generation of naval officers, it was Ramsey, somebody you don't hear about in naval history. But Ramsey ends up writing a series of articles about naval aviation and the use of war, dating to the early 1930s. One of them is aerial attacks on fleets at anchor. Another one debates the merits of naval aviation and whether you should have bombers or torpedo planes or fighter planes and the right mix. So he writes three or four articles in the 1930s. And in 1941, on December 7th, he is actually serving at Pearl Harbor and is the one who issues the message to the rest of the world that Pearl Harbor is under attack. This is no drill. So this is somebody you might think of, say, on September 11th, who had been warning about bin Laden or warning about potential terrorist attacks on the homeland, having to be in the middle of New York City and issuing the first reports.
The 1930s were one of two decades that were dominated by just a giant in American history, and that was FDR. Now, from a Navy point of view, besides being a wartime leader, FDR had a history with the U.S. Navy that went back to the World War I era when he was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy. What are some of the items that we have that bring the visitor to FDR?
Sure. We do have a letter from FDR to one of the admirals when he's serving as Assistant Secretary of the Navy. We also have a letter between one of my predecessors as the director of the Naval Academy Museum, Captain Harry Baldridge. FDR had visited the museum in 1940, and keep in mind that this was the only Navy museum in the country at the time. The building had been constructed between 1937 and 1939, in part with funds from the United States Naval Institute. And in fact, they would move in. There is a photograph in the exhibit of Admiral Leahy, who in 1938 was the chairman of the Institute board. Another member of the board was Captain Chester Nimitz. So these admirals, who are going to be significantly involved in major leadership positions in the Second World War, are with the Naval Institute and trying to propagate these ideas and really encouraging this next generation. So you see FDR communicating very closely with the Navy at this point, not only for the construction of this new Naval Academy Museum, but for some of the other issues. And we know that he is reading Naval Institute proceedings. We know that in a 1937 article, we have Captain Dudley Knox, a naval Navy retired, who writes an article on naval power as a preserver of neutrality and peace. And that becomes extremely helpful to President Roosevelt, who's trying to convince the public that preparation for war, far from being a cause of conflict, was the best means of avoiding it. So this is a perennial thought. You can even go back to Andrew Jackson, who makes the same suggestion in his farewell address to Congress, that if in order to prepare, in order to have peace, you must prepare for war. And one of that guarantors of freedom and peace is a large Navy. And certainly having FDR there at that time was as significant as having Teddy Roosevelt as Assistant Secretary of the Navy at the outbreak of the Spanish-American War, another one who had been a navalist, another Roosevelt, and goes on to become president.
A lot of the individuals that we cover in the Warrior Writers exhibit demonstrate the whole idea around its people and ideas and how the process of exchanging ideas helps our Navy and its country prepare for whatever challenges the future may bring. And as people look at what they see needs to be discussed, worked on, prepared for the future, sometimes people get it a little right. But you also can have periods of time, especially it seems times of great challenge, which is the 1930s, that people get a lot right. Who were some of the writers that when you look at what was put out in the 1930s, really were seeing as clear as you can at that point what they were going to see in the Second World War?
Well, I think there's no question that Logan Ramsey Sr. was at the forefront of that. You had others like Robert Kearney, the 14th Chief of Naval Operations from the class of 16, who writes about damage control and what to do during wartime. He talks about staff reorganization. But I think if you were to, you have other folks, Yates Sterling, for example, class of 1892, who writes about the need for more bases in the Pacific a decade before war breaks out with Japan. But I think probably the most significant group are the young Marines who are writing. In 1936, Robert Heinel eventually rises to the rank of Marine Colonel and wrote a number of articles for Proceedings. He's writing as a Yale NROTC student describing that program, and I think that's important because in previous podcasts, we've discussed the role of the Naval Academy and its graduates in forming these ideas and forming the Naval Institute itself. And so they were the majority of the officers who were writing, but now in the 1930s, you have other programs for individuals to become officers in the United States Navy. And this is part of that new generation. That's not to say that the Naval Academy graduates didn't have a role. In fact, they had a very significant role. You had some who were advocating having a Naval Rhodes Scholar, for example, and that's a program that's still alive and well, and Naval Academy graduates still become Rhodes Scholars. But there were two other Marines I think deserve special notice. In 1931, Major Harold Utley, a Marine Corps officer, writes an article, Special Boats for Landing Operations, mentioning that there aren't suitable landing boats for forced landings. There's no doctrine on what kind of boats they should possess. And he included drawings and photographs of some possibilities. And now Utley, a few years later, because of his writings, eventually becomes a strong influence on the Small Wars Manual. Another one is Lieutenant Wallace Green, United States Marine Corps. Again, he eventually rises to become the 23rd Commandant of the United States Marine Corps. He was a 1930 graduate, but he writes a history piece on a landing force of New Hampshire men who surprised and captured an English fort at the mouth of the Piscataqua River in 1775. So although he and others are writing very historical articles, another person was writing on Pearl Harbor, in fact, and its history in the United States Navy, they're really starting to think about these issues just a few years before the first Marine fleet landing exercises happen, beginning in 1935. And during these fleet landing exercises, this is the time where they're testing these boats out. They're testing amphibious landing. They're trying to determine what is going wrong so that they can correct it in case war happens. And I think it's important to note that this decade is also very reflective of diplomacy and foreign affairs and the coming crisis. These junior officers are very aware of what is happening, not only with the Soviet Union pushing east in one junior officer's article, but specifically about the Pacific. And the articles tended to be more more concentrated on Japanese, the push for Japanese power, rather than German power. There were very, very few. In fact, I was just going through a list of all the articles from that decade. You're hard-pressed to find really an article or two on Germany, with the exception of one historical article on how it conducted submarine operations during the First World War. Their eyes are to the Western Pacific. They are looking at Japanese growth, certainly well before, you know, 36, 37, 38, when Japan really starts ramping up throughout Southeast Asia. So I think in that way, the junior officers were very prescient. Ernest Eller, who becomes very well known in the naval community, naval history community, writes a piece in 1938 on Japan's rising sun. And these articles are almost reflective. They're not quite reflective, but they're an indication of what may come about in the next few decades. If you look at the past decade of Naval Institute Proceedings articles, you see very similar responses to trends and how we might respond to crises with regard to China's rising power in the Far East. So I think in that way, this new generation of officers in the 1930s overall gets it right. They know what's coming, and they're offering suggestions on how to deal with it. And I think that's one of the reasons why the United States Navy and Marine Corps in many ways self-adjusted very quickly after the beginning of the war, because they had already been thinking about these issues. They had already begun adapting and adjusting in terms of their role throughout the Pacific.
And when you look into the future and in memory of, you know, Yogi Berra, who passed this week, you know, it's really hard to predict the future, so to speak. But when people get it right, there's also some people that are looking at a challenge and see they might have the solution, but really don't quite get it right. And one of the things that we talked about with Craig was, especially in the beginning part of the decade before carrier aviation really matured, you know, people thought the dirigible was going to be the future. Were there some occasions you saw in some of the authors that they just really didn't quite see what was coming the way that it turned out?
Surprisingly, no. There were one or two articles about dirigibles during that decade, but they weren't the ones necessarily advocating it as a group. You saw that minimally. When you're looking at how they looked at the world around them, very few are getting world events wrong, even though they are, again, very junior officers. I think, again, this is the decade of prescience.
And with that, we bring the 1930s to a close. And I tell you what, we've got the huge swath that covers the 1940s coming up next. Look forward to the conversation, Claude.
Thank you very much.